Hello and welcome to the LLG Grapevine podcast. You're listening to Helen Bennett, LLG's Executive Director of Policy and Governance, and Dennis Hall, LLG Bulletin Editor.
Hello, everyone.
Now, last week, the Mayor of London, we found out, could be granted new calling powers to review blocked licensing applications in nightlife hotspots, and that's part of a pilot. Elsewhere, the Terrorism Protection of Premises Act 2025, known as Martin's Law, received royal assent, and the High Court ruled that the first tier tribunal is a suitable alternative remedy to judicial review in EHC plan disputes. But now on to a more focused look at some of the items in the LLG bulletin. Dennis, what's first?
Well, Helen, I thought we'd start with local government reorganisation. The Minister of State for Local Government and English Devolution has confirmed that every single area of two-tier authorities and their neighbouring smaller unitaries have responded to the government's invitation to submit interim plans for reorganisation by the deadline of the 21st of March. And in a written ministerial statement, Jim McMahon claimed that this demonstrated, without doubt, the groundswell consensus from communities that change is overdue and needed. The Minister also announced that £7.6 million would be made available in the form of local government reorganisation proposal development contributions to be split across the 21 areas. In the statement, McMahon claimed that the reforms would mean more accountable structures, making it much clearer for residents who they should look at and look to on local issues, with fewer but more empowered local political leaders who can focus on delivering for residents. And he added that council taxpayers would no longer pay an inefficient two-tier premium. Further in the statement, McMahon drilled down on what he said was a guiding principle, but not a hard target, of a population size of 500,000 or more for the new authorities, as set out in the original English Devolution White Paper.
Well, I know he also said, Dennis, that the government understood that there should be flexibility, quote, especially given it, our ambition to build our devolution alongside local government reorganisation. And the minister did continue with his statements in this regard, advising that the published guidance sets out that there may be certain scenarios in which this 500,000 figure does not make sense for an area, including on devolution, and this rationale should be set out in a proposal.
And in discussions with individual councils to parliamentarians and in interviews given throughout the process, the government have reinforced this position to aid local discussions. Equally, he said, it may be decided that population sizes around this figure or greater than it are the best fit locally. Instead of presenting a top-down solution for each area, our starting point is to support and empower local leaders and to respect their knowledge, expertise and insight. And on the reorganisation proposal development contributions, Jim McMahon said, this is the first time that capacity funding has been made available for reorganisation proposals, recognising the priority that this government attaches to this. And further information will be provided on how this will be allocated, and the government intend to make payments as soon as possible. Now, McMahon stressed that the submission of interim plans was not a decision point. It's the next stage in the process and enables councils to engage with the government on the issues that matter locally and receive support to develop their full proposals. We expect, he said, that local leaders will continue working collaboratively and proactively with each other, including by sharing information.
Well, officials at the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government will follow up with the 21 areas to discuss their interim plans, provide feedback and understand the collaboration and information sharing arrangements. And we understand the ministry will be speaking to Surrey as a priority in the coming days. They might have already done so. And the minister here said that with councils on the devolution priority programme during April and other areas after the local government elections in May, for Surrey, the deadline for proposals is in May, and for other areas, it will be later in the year, possibly September or November.
Yes, that's my understanding too. And McMahon also said, My department will consider these proposals against the criteria set out before consulting and taking a decision on which of those proposals which will be taken forward and implemented. This is a statutory process, he said, and affirmative legislation will be needed to establish new councils and abolish any of the predecessor councils. In his conclusion, the minister said, I acknowledge this is a significant undertaking, the largest structural reform of local government in half a century, and a fundamental part of our project to reform the British state so that it delivers for working people.
We will be introducing a programme of national league meetings in respect of devolution and local government reorganisation to pick up some of the issues that are going to flow from this vast piece of work. Not least, how not to lose your city status when reorganising. That's probably quite a big one, Dennis.
Indeed.
Now, let's take a look at what's going on in Wales at the moment with a landmark law in Wales to end profit from children in care. I found this fascinating. So this is the Health and Social Care Wales Bill. It's received royal assent. And for those unaware in England, this legislation ends completely private profit in children's residential and foster care. So care for looked after children will only be provided in Wales by the public sector, charitable or not-for-profit organisations in the future. And it's Wales, that is, are the first nation in the UK to do so. And the law will also enable the introduction of direct payments within continuing NHS healthcare so that disabled people and those with long-term health conditions have greater control over their care arrangements.
And Minister for Children and Social Care Dawn Bowden said, this landmark law represents a fundamental shift in how we care for our most vulnerable people in Wales, whose voices have been central to their decisions. And by removing profit from the care of looked after children, we're ensuring that funding goes towards improving outcomes for young people. And I'm proud, she said, that we're the first UK nation to take this bold step. Indeed, it is. And this reform, alongside empowering disabled people through direct payments, shows the government's unwavering commitment in Wales to creating care services which are built on compassion rather than commercial interests.
And the press release we looked at cites a young care experienced person called Joanne who submitted evidence to the decision to move forward in relation to this bill. And she says that knowing that this is now law makes me feel proud as I know that private profits won't be made from care experienced young people in the future. The money now will be reinvested for us to thrive and become the people that we want to be. And that these processes didn't happen overnight and that it took a lot of time and hard work from us and other young people, but we were not going to give up. And we will keep working hard to make the care system a better place for children and young people. And I thought that was really rather lovely. Now, Rhian Davies, who's the CEO of Disability Wales, said this new law will enable continuing healthcare recipients to make their own decisions regarding how and by whom their personal support is provided. It marks a significant milestone in progressing the right to independent living for all disabled people in Wales. Now, if anyone wants to examine the rationale behind the implementation of this law in more detail, links can be found in the Welsh Bulletin, but I'm interested to pay attention to whether any other nation, including England, takes a closer look at moving the care system away from the private sector. Dennis.
A very interesting item, that one to look forward to in the future as far as the other nations are concerned. Now, turning to something else, the Committee on Standards in Public Life has urged that public sector organisations must facilitate a culture where speaking up about concerns and learning from mistakes are seen as a personal duty and are valued by everyone in the organisation. The committee's report, entitled Recognising and Responding to Early Warning Signs in Public Sector Bodies, which was published at the end of March, also calls on organisations to focus on spotting early warning signs, boost accountability, and pursue transparent leadership to improve service delivery. Now, the report details how public sector bodies, including local authorities, can help recognise the early warning signs of emerging problems and to facilitate a culture of speaking up about those concerns. It includes examples of how organisations have identified and then responded to the early warning signs, and details 20 points for reflection to help assist leaders in considering whether improvements can be made to their organisations, processes, and their culture.
Well, the report noted that accountability mechanisms, say that word, are crucial for public service delivery. And it highlighted the following basic characteristics that should be common to all organizations. And this is a clear governance and accountability structure, a well-defined set of objectives, effective systems for monitoring performance and finance and risk. And of course, a strong and active sponsorship relationship between organizations in the same delivery chain. And on risk, the report noted that everyone within a public sector body has a responsibility to identify and report risks, adding that this is key, especially in regards to frontline workers and their managers, to have processes in place to identify potential issues. And the report added that encouraging a culture where people feel safe to speak up, and this is probably the most critical part, is a core part of an organization's ability to identify and act on risk.
And in addition, collating data and interpreting data intelligently is an important aspect of managing risk, as data allows links to be made across the records held by an organisation, according to the report. And the report goes on, meanwhile, that it noted that making information available about what an organisation does and how it does it can help the public and bodies charged with holding an organisation accountable. The report says withholding information merely to protect the institution or its members from scrutiny does not meet the Nolan principle of openness. And the report goes on, the more power an organisation has over citizens' lives, the more transparent it needs to be about what it is doing and how. The report says meaningful transparency also requires that information is presented in a manner that is clear, intelligible, and, where appropriate, in context, so that the full significance of the information can be understood.
Well, that is very important because I remember the Ofcom graphic, which I struggled with tremendously. So I think everyone needs to think very clearly about that. But also where this information is held, because websites can be notoriously tricky to navigate as well. The report said that public sector bodies need to support scrutiny bodies like ombudsmen, regulators, and inspectors in their task by being responsive to requests for information and by seeing them not as a threat, but as a provider of constructive challenge and a source of insight about how they can be better.
Elsewhere, the report urged public sector organisations to have processes in place for reviewing scenarios where things do not go according to plan, identifying the lessons that can be learned, then ensuring that these lessons are embedded within the organisation. Now, these are just some of the key points in this key report. There's a lot more in this report that will be of interest to monitoring officers and governance teams. So do take a close look, Ellen.
Thank you, Dennis. Now, the Department for Business and Direct Trade, that's had a few names over the years, have produced a promotional material Employment Rights Bill fact sheet on details on the measures, including with the Employment Rights Bill. Now, this is really important, not just to employment lawyers, but also to individuals to know their rights. And there are sweeping changes in this bill, and a few things that started off at the outset have subsequently dropped off. But this is a great fact sheet for highlighting what's happening across the entirety of the bill. Now, the department states that the bill will support family-friendly rights by improving flexibility and security. So I'm going to take a look at some of those provisions. We're going to have a list. We love a list here. So it's going to make existing entitlements to paternity leave and unpaid parental leave available from day one of employment. It will enable parents to take their paternity leave and pay after their shared parental leave and pay. It will introduce a new right to unpaid bereavement leave, allowing employees to take time from work to grieve the loss of a loved one. It will introduce new protections against dismissal for pregnant women, mothers on maternity leave, and mothers who return to work for a 6-month period after they return to work. And it's also going to strengthen these existing day one rights to request flexible working by requiring employers to explain the grounds on which they've denied a request and adding the requirement that a rejection of a request be reasonable.
And there's even more. The bill will end exploitative zero-hours contracts by introducing rights to guaranteed hours, reasonable notice of shifts, and payment for short-notice cancellation of shifts, with corresponding rights for agency workers. And it will end unscrupulous fire and rehire and fire and replace practices by considering dismissals for failing to agree to a change in contract as automatically unfair, except where businesses genuinely have no alternative. And the bill will remove the 2-year qualifying period of employment for the right to claim unfair dismissal, making it another day one right, while simultaneously enabling employers to ensure that the employee is a good fit for the job by establishing a new statutory probation period. And the bill goes further. It will strengthen collective redundancy rights by ensuring obligations to consult and notify apply when A, employers propose 20 or more redundancies at one establishment, or B, employers propose an amount of redundancies which meets a new threshold to be established in secondary legislation. And finally, it will close the maritime redundancy notification loophole, ensuring that operators who provide regular services to British ports cannot avoid the collective redundancy notification requirement.
Yes, Dennis. I think the last one's probably a reference perhaps to Carnival UK, who was the parent company of P&O Cruises and Cunard, who were accused of fire and rehire practices. It was all over the news. There's so much more to this bill. Other notable provisions include strengthening the duty on employers to take reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment of their employees in the workplace. Strengthening statutory sick pay by removing the lower earners limit and removing the waiting period, and it creates the basis for a fair work agency. This is interesting, which will bring together the enforcement of domestic agency rules, the national minimum wage, licensing of gang masters, and action against serious labour exploitation. And it will also take on additional functions such as the enforcement of holiday pay. So it's fascinating. It's a great fact sheet. The link, of course, is in the bulletin, and LLG will be setting up some training provision in respect to the employment bill with notification very soon. Dennis.
Thanks, Helen. Now, I turn to a report about electoral staff. The Local Government Information Unit has warned that while the 2024 general election was well managed, the resilience of electoral processes is questionable, with staff consistently reporting time and resourcing problems. In a report on last year's general election, the think tank also found that of the 259 electoral administrators surveyed, more than half, that's 60%, had experienced or seen a team member endure abuse at the polling station. The report found that election staff do not have sufficient time or resources to deliver action, to deliver elections without enduring intolerable stress. The report also raised concerns about the resilience and capacity of the electoral services workforce, postal votes, intimidation, and abuse of staff. And according to the think tank, 94% of administrators raised the challenge of organising snap elections as a problem, and 86% complained about the statutory timetable. Meanwhile, 87% described getting postal votes to electors on time as an issue, and a further 80% cited complex electoral law as being problematic. Funding woes were highlighted by 73% of respondents, while 72% voiced concern about recruiting polling station staff. And more than half of the respondents reported that they or another member of their team had experienced abuse or harassment at the general election. And almost a third reported disturbances at polling stations, according to the report.
Yes, and in light of the findings, the LGIU recommended the election timetable be extended and standardised across elections to ensure that there's enough time to deliver elections at an acceptable standard while reducing the personal burdens on staff. In considering these changes, attention should also be paid to the question of returning postal votes and how this can be made to work better for overseas electors. Now, turning to resourcing, the report recommended that the resources available to electoral services staff should be considered alongside their capacity to deliver adequate and standardised services across local authority areas, given the ongoing local authority funding crisis and its corresponding impact on electoral services teams. Now, automatic registration should also be considered, the report said, and the next changes to electoral legislation should be accompanied by a whole-scale consolidation of existing legislation. And the LGIU said that that consolidation should be developed alongside Scottish and Welsh governments to harmonise electoral law in policy areas where confusion is common, such as online postal vote applications.
Finally, it recommended that the government consider the protection of electoral services staff and temporary election workers alongside campaigners and electors, and review the legislation on electoral offences accordingly to ensure their protection as an equally vital part of the democratic electoral process. The 2024 general election was well managed, delivered without significant issues across the UK. And in general, resulted in a small number of visible issues, the report said. However, the report went on, many administrators raised with them problems that we, as outside observers, would be unlikely to see. Administrators are still going above and beyond to deliver elections, working extraordinary hours under difficult circumstances, wrestling with complex legislation and ever-shifting requirements, and contending with significant abuse and harassment, Helen.
Well, if anybody's interested in reading more about electoral reform, I would very much recommend the Association of Electoral Administrators Blueprint for Electoral Reform, which is available on their website. Now, finally, in the podcast, the Family Procedure Rule Committee is consulting on proposed changes to the Family Procedure Rules and Associated Practice Directions to ensure that experts instructed in family law children proceedings have the relevant qualifications and oversight to actually provide an expert opinion. It's flabbergasting this in some regards, because this consultation has come about because parliamentarians, campaigners, and the media have raised concerns regarding unregulated experts providing evidence in family court cases and the standard of such evidence. Now, the background to this states that these experts often are often using the title psychologist, may be instructed to give evidence or offer diagnoses which they are not qualified to undertake. Now, in the case of RC, sorry, RECI, and the president of the family division, the president delivered a judgment on the appeal of the instruction of an unregulated psychologist who gave evidence on the disputed concept of parental alienation. Now, within his judgment, the president highlighted the need for due rigor in the process of expert instruction, and that regulation of the title psychologist was a matter for parliament. It's a bit like calling yourself a lawyer, I think. Officials have considered various solutions to this issue and deemed that the most appropriate route was to pursue changes via the family procedure rules.
And if an expert's profession is not subject to regulation by a UK statutory body, there is no requirement for that expert to join a professional association that oversees compliance with minimum qualification standards and continuous professional development. And as a result, the current process allows for the instruction of unregulated experts whose lack of regulation does not provide parties with redress over misconduct. And this can lead to an uneven situation where the standard of expert evidence does vary depending upon whether or not the expert is subject to proper checks from a professional body.
It's interesting, isn't it? The aims of these changes are, of course, to ensure that only experts with the relevant qualifications, experience, and oversight are instructed in the family court. And for an expert to be regulated by a UK statutory body, accredited by the Professional Standards Authority, or indeed regulated by an improved regulator under the Legal Services Act 2007. And then they must comply with a set standard of education and conduct. And this change, the division says, will improve the consistency of the standard of expert evidence presented to the court and will also provide parties to proceedings a clear route to raise the concerns over the conduct of an expert. Now, the consultation closes 5 p.m. on the 6th of June. And as I've said before, this government likes to have a whole variety of closure dates, not just 11:59. So it's very important to double check the closing time of the consultations you want to respond to. And on that note, that's it for another edition of the podcast. You can read more on that item, the items discussed today, and many more besides by going to bulletin number 13, available on the LRG website now. So it's goodbye from me.
And from me too. Goodbye now.